Good morning. I'm opening this meeting of Subcommittee on Human Services of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Today is June 1st. I'm opening a work session on Senate Bill 454.
Okay, thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, Senate Bill 454 relates to the mandatory provision of sick time. The measure was previously heard here in the committee on May 7th. We have three amendments on OLIS today. The A39, which is the LFO recommended, and then the A40 and the A43 proposed amendments. The fiscal impact has not changed dollar-wise since you last saw it. Still has a total funds impact of $4,424,865. We have, however, added an explanatory sentence at the end of the fiscal indicating that there is likely an impact to school districts, public universities, and community colleges. And we do have some testimony from Senator Denbro today, if you'd like to hear from him first.
First, I'd like to hear from
one amendment before us.
Yes, I will.
Madam Chair, I move the dash A39 amendment to Senate Bill 454.
Thank you. The motion has been made. Let's hear the discussion, what this amendment is. Looks like we have two legislators.
Can I bring my collaborator or something?
Yes, please.
We had hoped he was safely tucked away in his committee, but somehow here he is. Anyway, I'm Michael Denbro, state senator for District 23. That's Northeast and Southeast Portland and the city of Maywood Park.
Paul Holby, State Representative, District 8, with South Eugene and South Central Lane County.
And so before you are the Dash 39 amendments. I think they were posted on Friday, and they are what we believe to be the fulfillment of what we promised you during the public hearing, which was to make some changes. Necessary changes clarifying the businesses that already have paid time off proposed provisions and how to make sure that they would work out more easily with this new system. We have worked on the accrual rate to again make it easier for businesses to have the new system cohere with the way they do their payroll calculations. One of the issues that industry was really interested in was having the ability to require employees to take their leave in 4-hour increments if it's a situation in which it's hard to get somebody to come in for just 1 hour, which is that's the standard rate. That is the rate under the Oregon Family Leave Act. But you know, we heard that was creating potential problems, particularly in manufacturing industries. And so the Dash 39s deal with that and create situations in which they can require employees to take their leave in 4-hour increments. We also clarified, so I think already when we had our public hearing, we had distinguished, we had set the statewide standard of employer size at 10 and grandfathering in Portland. One of the things that the bill was silent on is how those 10 employees statewide or 6 employees for Portland would be calculated. And so we have clarified just how that is done, both for existing businesses and for new businesses. So roughly, it's using the OFLA method of calculating eligibility. And again, what we're talking about here is the difference between whether the leave needs to be paid or unpaid. Employers of any size under this bill are not going to be allowed to discipline or terminate their employees for requesting or taking sick leave. But if the employer size is more than 10, then that leave would be paid up to 40 hours a year. I think that, you know, the method that Rep. Holvey and I came up with is actually an improvement over the OFLA method, even though it's based on the OFLA method. Under OFLA, there's a look back to the previous year. Every time that an employee requests leave, you do a look back over the last year and see if there are 20 weeks in which the number of employees was at that threshold. What we put into this bill was something that is much more stable and predictable. That is, the calculation would be done once a year, at the beginning of the year, whether the employer chooses to use the calendar year or the fiscal year. At the beginning of that year, they would do a calculation of the previous year, and then everyone would know for the entire year to come whether the leave would be paid or unpaid. It just seemed much simpler. And we've been talking, we may want to sometime in the future revisit the OFLA methodology to bring that into line with this. But that's, of course, for another day. I think those are the major things. Rep. Holvey?
As well, in that vein, I suppose, in determining, looking back to the previous year, for new employers, they'd be able to look back in the current year and in the last 20 weeks, essentially. But once they get to 20 weeks, they can look back in the 20 weeks, whether it's in the current year or in the past year, to make that determination for new employers. The other thing is, I know there was a little bit of discussion. We did some clarification on front loading, which you'll find in section one, the discussion about front loading, which allows employers to establish the amount of paid sick time at the beginning of the year and then just track the usage of that paid sick time going forward as being something that would be equivalent and acceptable under this bill. It was previously discussed under the equivalent paid time off policies, but we felt it was important to separate this out because some employers may want to choose that methodology up front as well. So we clarified that. There was also, as you recall, a little bit of confusion about piece rate work in our discussion with Senator Thompson, who was here with discussing the agricultural community and piece rate work and how that is accounted for as well. And so you'll see in Section 3 a clarification on that piece work rate. It didn't really change the policy, but made it more clear how that paid sick leave is awarded to those workers that work on peacetime. Essentially, if they had a previously established regular rate of wage, and then at some point they're doing piecework, that for the same employer, that employer would pay the sick leave at that regular rate of pay. If they don't have a regular rate of pay and they just do piecework, their employers are currently required to pay at least the minimum wage, and so that would be the paid sick leave rate for those workers that have that work at piece rate and don't have a regular rate of pay. And those are pretty much the changes that we've made to the bill, which was in the dash 29. These are now the dash 39s. So there's been a little bit of work on the specific language to make sure we continue to try to address clarity. Happy to answer any questions.
Senator Steiner-Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Denbrough, Representative Holvey, one question I've neglected to ask. With the new provisions for employers for whom it would be difficult to allow leave in one-hour increments, one of the requirements is that they would have to offer 56 hours of leave per year. Another part of the bill says that people can only take a maximum of 40 hours per year. I haven't looked in the detail in the language, but is it clear that in those cases where there are these special exceptions, that if they get 56 hours a year, they can take 56 hours a year?
Yes. And I forget where it's actually located, but there is kind of notwithstanding language.
Thank you very much. Just want to make sure about that.
And I will add one thing that we, one of the last things actually that we included was, you know, we heard a concern that if you were an employer, let's say you're a manufacturer, and you want to use that four-hour standard for the people who are on the manufacturing line, but you know, you have others, other parts of the company that where maybe, you know, it's not such a hardship. But the employer has an interest in having a consistent employee policy. We are allowing them to do that. So, you know, if it's if the employer prefers to have, you know, one consistent policy where everyone would need to take it 4 hours, they will be allowed to do that.
Yes, Representative Stone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So on the same topic, I'm looking at page 9, section 7, lines 21 through 30. I'm trying to figure out what undue hardship would, what would constitute undue hardship for the 1 hour. And if I'm reading this correctly, is this bill saying that in section C, so again, page 9, bottom of the page, line 27, that Boley will decide later what undue hardship means? And so at this point, we don't know what undue hardship means?
So undue hardship is, you know, simply, you know, it's simply stated here, you know, if to offer it in, to require 1 hour implementation would impose an undue hardship. And, you know, we decided that it would be better, you know, I think all the parties agreed that it would be better to leave that, the examples of that up to Boley to define. And what we're talking about here is, you know, Boley will, I mean, Boley won't necessarily make every decision, but will put out a set of rules that will give examples of this. I mean, a couple of things that came immediately to mind was, you know, as I mentioned, you have that manufacturing line where it's hard to get somebody to cover for another person for an hour because the line has to keep going. Mm-hmm. And but on the other hand, it's hard to get somebody to come in and work for just 1 hour. So that the manufacturing line would be one example, I think, that they would articulate. Another might have to do with the distance traveled, you know, to the work site. If it's going to require a fair amount of travel to get to the work site, that seems like requiring a 1 hour implementation, allowing 1 hour implementation could cause an undue hardship. But, you know, we assume that there might be other examples out there, and that's, it seems appropriate to leave to rulemaking rather than for us to, you know, try to imagine every possible situation and put it into the bill.
And I would like to just add that the danger of us putting that, trying to develop that kind of a list and putting it into statute is that we would leave something out that we hadn't anticipated, and therefore an employer wouldn't be able to show undue hardship. It really is something that could be different for each employer around the state. And so there's just logistically no way to anticipate what all those hardships would be. And if we started putting a list into statute of that, we would preclude potentially many employers from being able to avail themselves of that four-hour increment.
May I follow up?
Yes.
Thank you. And so just for the record, for I know there's a lot of interested parties watching this right now, yeah, or will be watching it later. If an employer is concerned about whether or not their situation would be approved by Boley as undue hardship, how can an employer speak into that process with Boley now in order to make sure their business's situation is on that list?
I would say that they probably should wait until Boley writes the rules. And then check with Boley. One of the elements of the fiscal to this bill is having personnel at Boley who will be dedicated to helping with the transition and answering questions and looking at this very issue. We are hoping that those questions can be answered in advance of any potential complaint. I mean, ultimately, this will be a complaint-driven process, but we want to have as few complaints as possible. And again, just to remind you that we have we put into the bill a one-year transition period where there would be no penalties for any issues because we're hoping that that year can be used to get all this stuff clarified and worked out.
And I will add that the bill does instruct BOLI to establish rules for that criteria of undue hardship. And so that's in the bill, so they will have to do that.
Yes, Senator Winters.
Just a point of clarity, because you said in following your testimony, we will, and I'm assuming when you use the term we will as it pertains to rules, that you're referring to BOLI, not the legislative branch, since we do not actually promulgate rules.
That's correct.
So if I really look, then all the responsibility for promulgating rules will be with BOLI to determine what is undue hardship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there is no, and I'm going to ask the question whether or not there is the ability for those who are affected by the rules to have input into BOLI to make certain that that definition meets with what the industries, not just one industry, actually find that fits with them.
And that's correct, too. The BOLI rulemaking process is a public process, which is open for input from the public.
And if I could add, Madam Chair, Senator Winters, I think it's very valuable that we're having this discussion right now because, you know, I think that we are putting the legislative intent on the record of, you know, the kind of hardship that we've been talking about in developing this language and providing, I hope, some direction for BOLI to use as a starting point for that public process.
Madam Chair, follow-up. Since I wasn't at the policy committee hearing, it's still, to me, the definition of undue hardship is kind of just esoteric out there and vague. So I, you know, I like I said, I wasn't at the hearing, and hopefully the policy discussion did have in-depth discussion about what is undue hardship.
Yeah, and if I can clarify, I don't think we really talked about this when it was still in the policy committee. These discussions came about after the fact in our meetings with industry and advocates.
Thank you. Senator Bates.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to make a comment and then ask a question of you and of LFO both. I know it's kind of a tense moment right now for everybody. There's people on both sides of this question. First, I want to thank you both for the good work you've done the last 2 or 3 weeks to get this in place. I know you've worked very hard to refine this. The Dash 39s indicate there's been a few changes along the way from the original bill, and I appreciate what you've done. I have absolute proof this morning that there is a God in heaven and he has a wicked sense of humor. I drove back home Thursday night thinking about this bill all night. And it's a four-hour drive, a lot of thinking goes on, and then I went to my office the next morning. We have an office of 11 people. We're part of a larger group, so we have earned time off that is better than this. But I walked in my office that morning, and I had two people out of my 11 people with head colds, and three people out with morning sickness because I found out they'd just gotten pregnant the previous month. We've changed the water in the water cooler, drained it immediately. So I kind of know what it's like to have your workforce down by 50% at 8 o'clock in the morning. And we scrambled around and made do. But I thought it was kind of humorous that I walked in that morning with everything kind of falling apart in the office when I'm thinking about this bill all night. So that was that. My concern about the bill is that there's complications of the bill. It's so complicated to try to make these kind of changes in businesses, especially small businesses. I frankly prefer the 25 rule, not the 10 rule. I feel uncomfortable with the 10 rule and what we're doing to small businesses. And the complexity of this for a small business is really significant. When you have 200, 300, 400 employees, we can write rules and we have some leeway and ways of covering each other, as I did Friday morning. if I really only had 11 employees in my office, which I do, but I'm part of a bigger group, as I said, I'm not sure how I would deal with all that. Two of the ladies came to me that afternoon by phone and said, I don't want to take my ETO off for this. I want you to hold that. I want to save it for after the baby's born. And I understood that. We did that for them. But that kind of complication, that kind of difficulty gives me pause about this bill. My question to you is, we're going to put this in place. We're going to see it start to work out. I would hope you'd be open to making changes later if we find out that we've just overreached. Mm-hmm. We have too small of employers in the situation, and the system is too complex for those people. We don't want to be putting people out of business doing this. We do want better benefits for our employees. But I'm hoping you're open in a year or two. If this is not working, that we step back and say, wait a minute, we've got to move up to 15, or we've got to move up to 25. Something of that nature, be ready to go, because I'm very concerned about implementation of this.
I'm always open to improving anything, Senator. I appreciate that, and always try to keep an open mind going forward as well. I think we have worked very hard to simplify this bill as much as possible. If somebody does quarterly payroll or statements as required, they know the number of hours that people work and should be able to divide that by the appropriate number to figure out how much paid sick time they have or how much sick time they have in general. So I think that the real elements of this are not near as complicated as the language. The language was put in to make sure that we had some real clarity about what this bill is and how it works. I think the implementation of it is not near so complicated. I think that we had testimony from businesses in Portland who have been, you know, working under this type of structure for a year and had very few businesses come forward saying, oh, this is unworkable, it's too difficult. And so it did give us a little bit of encouragement that the actual mechanics of doing this are not near as complicated as this language.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a follow-up comment. One thing I did hear from the community, the business community, very clearly is they want it to be the same across the state. It would be impossible for them if it was like city by city or county by county. The other questions are for LFO real quickly. Generally speaking, before we set a bill out committee, we want to know the fiscal implications for the state. And I've not seen the cost of higher ed for this, the community college for this, for K-12. When would we expect to see those numbers?
Co-chair, LFO has done the analysis on the impact to the state agencies. I would point out now that school districts and public universities and community colleges, while they do receive a lot of funding from the state, they are not necessarily state agencies, so we haven't done an in-depth analysis on the effect to them nor to cities and counties, but we have included that there is an impact to those in the fiscal analysis because we felt that was pertinent.
Follow-up. K-12 is not a lot of funding. It's 50% of the funding. We should know what the cost of K-12 is. Community colleges and higher ed, while we funded a much lower level, unfortunately, we need to know their costs too, and we really need to know those this week if we possibly could. We should be able to get that information, and I think it's pertinent for this committee to know that and to know what we're voting on as we go forward.
Okay. I'll see what I can do.
Thank you.
And Senator, if I may, I believe K-12 public schools are already required by ORS 332 to provide 10 days of sick leave. So I would imagine that the impact to them would be minimal.
Follow up? Yes, I was aware of that. Also aware that substitute teachers can claim sick leave also.
Right.
I'd like to know what other employees of the districts could now claim if they can and what the cost would be. I think it's a pertinent question. It may not be that much compared to the entire budget, but I'd like to know.
Oh, certainly.
Okay.
Okay.
Let's see. We have Representative Stark, and then Olson, and then Kenny Geyer, and then Boone.
All right. Thank you.
I have for the House.
Two questions that I'm aware of at this moment. One, with the section that excludes family members, does that exclude family members from the 10 count as well, or are they included in the 10 count? meaning, so if I have 9 employees, or I have 10 employees, but 2 of them are family members, does that count as 10, or is that 8 employees?
Well, I think that your family members are people, too. Under this bill, no, they would not be counted. They would not be, they don't come under the definition of employee.
Okay, so they
would not, yeah, they would not count.
Unless they are the actually employees. If the family members are employees, they're...
Well, if they're, and I forget how we worded it, if it's a spouse or a... Did we actually spell that out?
You included that, according to the Family Leave Act, what a family member was.
Right.
But I don't see that it's, and it says that they're excluded from the mandatory paid sick leave, but it doesn't say, or I don't see if it says whether or not they are count toward the 10 count or not. And I can think of a lot of small businesses that are right around 10 that have 1 or 2 family members that could put it over or under that 10 count.
That's an interesting question.
May I just jump under in? Page 2, I think, is where you're after, and that deals with line 6 on what it's exempt. And I think what Representative Stark's question is pretty accurate, because that's going to be a total calculation.
So they are not counted.
I would say they're not counted, because they're not considered employees.
Okay. And may I do my next question on that while we ponder that response? And just for my own clarification, others in the room may know how this works a little better. I'm looking at page 3, line 9 through 12, when it talks about the regular rate of pay, and that being based on the time on line 11, the employee earns from the employer at the time the employee uses the paid sick leave. And I'm thinking about the longer-term prevailing wage jobs. You know, I used to cut sheet metal, and we looked forward to those times where we had a 3-month job that was prevailing wage. So during that season, what I would have considered my regular rate of pay was significantly higher than the rest of the year. So how does this factor into prevailing wage? Is it ever considered as part of the sick leave, or is it only what their base rate is when they're not on the prevailing wage? How does that factor in?
I assume it's defined as what the pay rate would have been if that person could have worked on that day. So if they were doing prevailing wage work, then I would assume that it would be at the prevailing wage rate. If they were not, if it was a non-prevailing job, then they would be paid that lower rate.
If it were more higher.
Yeah. Would that open up employers? Because some employers can shift, you know, if they send out 2 crews to do sheet metal work, one job may be prevailing wage and one may not, and they can shift crews. Would an employer have the ability to kind of mess with that by, oh, well, your crew, since you were out sick that day, your crew is therefore the non-prevailing wage versus the prevailing wage?
Employers can always try to screw around with things. I would hope that wouldn't happen. And, you know, if there were a complaint, then Boley would have to look at that situation.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay. So I understand on page 4, lines 13, dealing with the identification of what you did with the Family Medical Leave Act, 20 work weeks. Any consideration, how does this play out with the seasonal workers and the Department of Ag's 180 days?
Paul, you want to address that?
So your question was any about the seasonal workers, how this plays out with seasonal workers?
Correct.
Well, a seasonal worker would be eligible just the same as anyone else, but they do have to accrue the hours is the same as under the bill. So that would apply. I guess the question is, does the employer have 20 weeks worth of time where the average of each of those weeks has 10 or more employees? If not, then the employer is not subject to the paid sick leave. If the employee is a seasonal worker, say, you know, they accrue hours, and upon 90 days they could be eligible, but only if the employer, you know, is required to pay paid sick leave, you know, based on those previous 20 weeks.
Okay. Yeah. So the question would be, if I follow up, you know, did the employer have 10 or more workers for 5 months out of the previous year, roughly 5 months? And if so, then, you know, then they would have met the threshold, and if not, they would be below the threshold.
Okay. Thank you. Follow up. Thank you. So page 2, line 17, describes the employer located in a city with a population exceeding 500,000 includes, but is not limited to, an employer that maintains any office, store, restaurant, or establishment in this city. I walk away from that saying there's a nexus here. So if I have a post office box, or better yet, let's say I do have a small office with two people that work downtown Portland, and I have several businesses with three or four people that don't work in Portland but are out in the state, this applies to them.
Yeah. I'm not sure I understand your question, but so you're saying an employer has two employees in Portland and how many outside of Portland? Clearly, they wouldn't, if they only had two in Portland, they wouldn't be subject to the Portland ordinance, but if they had 10 statewide, they would be subject to the statewide sick leave. I believe that.
And again, just to remind you what we tried to do here, one of the problems that Portland has experienced is they've been wrestling with the question of workers who are, they're based outside of Portland, but they travel into Portland to work. Maybe they're doing deliveries, or they're a contractor, which is doing, you know, a temporary job. Their workers are doing a temporary job in Portland. We decided that to make this simpler, more consistent, more predictable, we would focus on where the employer is physically located, and that's why you know, we use the term maintains an office, store, restaurant, or establishment in the city.
Okay, and just an additional question. Okay, well, first of all, I disagree with you on that. Mainly because of the way the language is written there, but it's not limited to. But I'll move on with that. A question of LFO. I appreciate the questions and also the comments that Senator Bates was asking concerning this whole issue. But Mike, I guess a little more penetrating question is, have you in fact received that information from K through 12 and higher ed?
We, co-chairs and Representative Olson, we have not received dollars from K through 12. We have received an estimate from universities that did not give any analysis into where they got their information from, and we have not received anything from community colleges.
Okay, thank you. And then just one more question of our esteemed guests. I don't know if anybody has asked you this question, you know, on record, and I would be really interested in your input on this. Why sick leave versus personal time off? Because it seems to me like you would probably gain a huge amount of support from businesses across the state if you went that direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll start and Representative Holby can follow. You know, I think that what really drove this from the beginning was, you know, concerns about people having to go to work sick and having to choose between, you know, taking care of themselves and their livelihood. And when I say themselves, you know, their children as well. A real concern about kids having to go to school sick because their parents couldn't take the time off to care for them or take them to the doctor or whatever. That, you know, I would say was, you know, a really, you know, primary initial impetus into this. Now, we do recognize that there are many employers, and maybe a growing number, that are nesting sick leave within a larger framework of paid time off. And that's why we put in Section 4 of the bill, which allows employers to have broad paid time off programs, as long as within that program an employee is able to use up to 40 hours of sick leave each year. Now, if they happen to use that leave for vacation or other personal leave, they don't get sick leave, paid sick leave in addition to that. You know, they can take sick leave, but they're not going to be paid for it. The legislation makes that clear. So we're trying to have it both ways as much as possible.
Yeah, I think that does describe the paid time off policies. I mean, we do allow employers to use those, as described by Senator Dimbro. But really, I think the overarching thing is we really want to make sure people aren't choosing between paying the rent or putting food on the table and going to work sick, because they can't afford to stay home and be sick, or stay home and take care of an extremely ill family member. It doesn't seem to be good public policy. As we all know, when people come into this building sick, it seems to run through the entire building. Doc Bates, I'm sure, is well aware of that. And you have the same problem in the workplace and the same problem in schools. And you know, that has an economic impact too that's really not figured into this discussion. But it is very difficult for families who are faced with, oh, if I don't go to work this day and I miss this day of work, I'm going to be short on rent, so I go to work sick, whether I'm in the food industry or taking care of children or taking care of the elderly. This is not a good public policy, and we need, unfortunately, the demographics and the wage scales of a lot of Oregonians do not put them at a level where they can afford to take extra days off to be sick. And I think this public policy is overdue.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mine was more of just a comment following on Chair Bates's comments as well. There's a lot of questions about the size and what is often perceived as a more undue burden the smaller the employer is. But I was just going to say, looking at it from another point of view, I thought your example was actually really good, because I'm guessing that you as an employer are a good employer and that you offer paid sick time off. And those two people that had head colds, had they not had that, might have come in. And I think that the huge advantage I see to this bill is threefold. One is to the worker, him or herself, to make sure that they nip it in the bud and don't miss so many days of work, or find a lump in her breast and actually get it checked out before it becomes a much bigger problem. Secondly, it's to the rest of the workforce. And I think, particularly on a small business, if you have 11 people in your health clinic and two of them come in and get sick, you could actually be wiping out a lot of your entire workforce, and that's even harder. So I would actually argue that for smaller businesses, the impact of not having something like this and having colds and flus run through that business could be even more devastating in a smaller business. And then third, of course, is to the clients. And so the healthcare business is a really great one, in that you don't want those people with colds coming in. I get that there might be a triage. You might actually have to cancel some appointments for some patients, and you take the more serious ones. If you couldn't have scrambled and gotten people into work into that clinic, but that again is probably better than having vulnerable patients treated by people with colds. So I just wanted to make that comment. I don't feel like that comes out enough. We talk about small business and the complications of the 6 versus 10. Obviously, I would have liked to have seen 6 statewide. I hope that we in the future consider that when we look at what kind of logistical burdens this compromise might be. I hope that is still on the table as well.
Thank you, Representative Boone.
Thank you. Going way back to the beginning of the House part, talking about the exemptions, and it does say this, that the exempt employees who are covered by a collective bargaining are exempt, then, but it also has, and are employed through a referring hiring hall or similar referral by the union, and whose benefits are delivered through a multi-employer trust. So it sounds like if you're under a union contract, you're probably exempt because it's already covered under that.
If I can clarify, no, that's actually not the case. That this is, odds are, most union contracts do have leave policies that are at least as generous as this. But this is actually talking specifically about those workers, mainly in the construction trades, who do their work through a hiring hall and have a multi-employer contract. So there's not one employer that they're accruing sick leave for. It's, the entire industry under their, for all the signatories to the collective bargaining agreement. And so we wanted to make that really clear here, that this exemption is limited to them. If you're a construction worker and all your work and you're not hired in any way through a hiring hall, you're just permanently attached, you're working for a particular employer, then you would be treated like anyone else. And we have the expert sitting next to me. He probably wants to add something.
That language, he's correct, is very specific to collective bargaining agreements where there is use of a hiring hall and multi-employer plans, which, is really limited to construction. There are a few others. There's trade show workers and some other stage hands and those sorts of workers that operate in the same venue where they're on call for several different employers and they have one shot, and if they're not there, they have to use somebody else. And so their plans are administered by a multi-employer, so that it'd be difficult to figure out which employer was liable to pay the paid sick time. And so that's why they're exempted, and they already have in those plans covered time off for things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So just a couple of comments too, going way back again to, and I'll just use a restaurant as an example. Pretty much everybody's worked in a restaurant at some point in their lives. You come to work, and you start getting sick to your stomach, and that's the worst thing to happen there. Or you have an injury that's precluding you from lifting or whatever. So you thought you'd try it, and it didn't work out. So if it seems, in my experience, the manager always kicked in and would pick up the slack, especially during the busy time. And so I know that happens in some cases in our construction company. If somebody's sick and they can't, we get a call at 7 in the morning, they can't come in, somebody picks up the slack there. But the final comment, if I may, and Representative Olson brought it up about just paid time off. A lot of different countries have this where they just have X number of weeks of paid time off. You can use it for vacation, sick leave, parental leave or whatever, and stuff like that. And it's up to the employee how it's used. And then if they don't use it, they can donate it to somebody who may need it, especially like maybe had a difficult pregnancy and have to be home or in bed a lot. And so, we hear that here. We get emails from our personnel services asking, to donate your sick time or whatever to somebody who is experiencing cancer treatment or whatever. And so I'm just, and he asked it, and I'm just asking it too, and I understand and appreciate your answers, but just how much was that considered? As just paid time off without delineating sick and separating it out.
Right, yes. Representative Boone, it was...
What's the deal?
There's a spider that keeps wandering around.
There's a sick creature
up there. I don't mind it, but it's distracting.
I'm actually watching it from here.
Yeah, exactly. It's the spider. It's fine. I don't want it dead, but,
Okay. Okay. Too late.
Yeah. Too late?
Have to take some bereavement leave. Representative Boone, we definitely did take that into consideration. I'm not sure that either that PTO was really well delineated in the original bill as introduced, and certainly the ability to donate time was not included. In fact, it was Senator Bates who suggested that. And so now, you know, both of those are very much a part of this bill because we heard they're not required, right? We're not requiring anyone to have paid time, to do paid time off, nor are we requiring any employer to allow employees to donate their time to one another. But it is allowable. Again, we're trying to make this as flexible as possible for employers who want to do the right thing.
We have a motion on the table. I think we're ready to vote. Senator Winters, did you have a final comment on this?
Just very quickly, and I just want to concur with Senator Bates of making certain that we've got all of the impact statements on K through 12 higher ed and others, and just a question of whether or not we did an economic impact statement on business, or whether we talked to Econ Northwest or others, because at the end of the day, all that we do here will have finally an impact on those that we're setting this policy for. So if we have not, and if that was not a part of the testimony, you know, I think those who are engaged in talking about the fiscal impact that affects the businesses in our state, particularly this state, you know, 80% or better what we do is small businesses in this state. So, you know, if we have not done so, and I don't know whether legislative, fiscal, or revenue have gone down that pathway, but I think it would be helpful for us to know what those impacts are.
Madam Chair, can I just make a comment, sort of echoing a comment that Representative Holvey made? You know, one of the the real benefits for us of having Portland essentially run a pilot project around this for a year and a half now, and there we're talking about employer size of six. We did not have a single Portland business come to us during any of our hearings to complain that this was creating an undue burden for them. We heard from many people that they were afraid in advance that this was going to create, an expensive burden on them. And, you know, what I've heard in a number of one-on-one conversations with people is that their fears, fortunately, have not panned out. There were some concerns, and I mentioned them before, in initially implementing the Portland ordinance for employers that had already generous plans how to make the round hole, the square peg round hole, round peg square hole work out, and we've frankly benefited from that experience, and that led us to make this much more flexible in many ways than the Portland ordinance. So I think that you can speculate always about the outside cost of something, but I think it's really more relevant to look at what the experience is where it actually has been used.
Madam Chair, with all due respect, all the state does not look like the metropolitan Portland area. And so I need to put that on the record because people are listening in. I would love as a legislator to have the wage level and everything looking like Portland, but some of our rural communities do not enjoy the same average wage and what have you that we have in Portland. So I just think that it's well to understand what the impacts are, not just in Portland, but for our state as a whole.
And I really appreciate that. I think it is worth noting, that the state is not completely homogeneous in terms of economies and things. But one of the things we did hear from a lot of businesses is they were really unnerved by the likelihood that we would have different paid sick leave policies from one city to the next and how devastating that would be on business and the economy. So not addressing this seemed to have potentially even more severe economic impacts than in trying to address it. So it is, all as always, a balance.
Thank you. I think we've completed introduction to an understanding of this amendment. There's a motion before us. I don't see any more discussion. Are there objections to the motion? Two.
Yes.
And one here. Motion passes. I anticipate that we will take this up again at our next meeting. We will be here with or without the spider to continue discussing Senate Bill 454. I am closing this work session on 454. We are adjourned.
Thank you, Nancy.
We are adjourned.
Thank you, Dan.